This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Jetzt gibt's Cheez-It, ein neuer knuspriger Snack, der köstlich nach Käse schmeckt. Hol dir jetzt deine Packung im Handel und das Beste, du kannst sie einmal gratis testen. Wer will heute Abend den Cheez-It? Cheez-It, der Cheez-It. Jetzt zum Gratis-Testen. Teilnahme ab 18 Jahren. Kauf- und Kassenbon-Upload bis 30. Juni erforderlich. Nur solange der Vorrat reicht. Teilnahmebedingungen auf Aktionspackungen und auf cheezit-aktion.de.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Right now, there's a big domestic row going on about just how bad Britain's fiscal situation is, i.e. whether we have any money, and who knew about the spending gap and when. Now, that particular argument we can leave to the politicians. But the underlying question is a factual one. What is our fiscal position and what are the prospects for its improvement? With the new government's first budget due at the end of next month, a lot depends on just how big our problem is. So, what's the answer? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. With me, I have Paul Johnson, Director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, Merin Khan, Economics Editor of The Times, and Chris Giles, Economics Commentator at the Financial Times. Paul Johnson, if we look at the key economic indicators, what can we say about the fiscal health of the British economy?
So looking at the public finances, we're in a difficult position. And it's worth trying to get underneath that. We're in a difficult position in particular because debt, the amount that the government owes, is high. The Chancellor and the now Shadow Chancellor were both very keen to say they want to get debt falling over the period of this Parliament. And on current plans, it's not really falling. And it's not really falling despite the fact that taxes are high. They're high by historic standards, at least, if not so much by international standards, but taxes are high. And it doesn't look like we're spending a great deal, because if you look across the public services, everything seems to be falling apart. But actually, we are spending quite a lot. Why do things look so difficult when debt is high and taxes are high? Well, it's partly because we've just accumulated a lot of debt over time through the financial crisis, through COVID, and so on. It's partly because debt interest payments are therefore extremely high by historic standards. We've got lots of debt and interest rates are high, so we're paying a lot in debt interest. And we've had a relatively slow growing economy for a long period of time, so there's not a lot of money in the kitty to pay for public services, welfare, and so on. And clearly we had that period of austerity through the 2010s when there were big cuts in spending on a range of public services. Now, we're not cutting spending at the moment, but certainly in some areas we haven't actually replaced the cuts that happened back in the 2010s. So when Rachel Reeves talks about it being a very difficult period for the public finances, she's right. It is a very difficult period for the public finances.
Merin Khan, let's address this famous black hole that people talk about. Last September, we talked about whether or not there would be significant fiscal problem after the election, and actually pretty much identified that there was. And certainly Paul had been banging on about it, and a lot of the rest of you had been banging on about it long before the election. So are we just talking about the same one we identified back in September, or have there been additions since then?
So if we're going to talk about, I guess, the most current black hole, so the one that Rachel Reeves unveiled to the press and to the public a couple of weeks after coming into the office in July, which was the £22 billion black hole, I guess that's a separate, newly, freshly calculated estimate for what the government, well, the previous government, was overspending in this fiscal year. So it's probably a smaller black hole than the bigger one we'd be talking about for a long time, which is the idea of the hole in the public finances every time a Chancellor does a budget, which is about meeting our fiscal rules and that black hole. But the £22 billion is very specific, actually. It's actually about £35 billion, and it shrinks to £22 because Rachel Reeves also announced lots of emergency measures that she wanted to do pretty much yesterday to get it down to £22 billion. And that's been, I think, a quite highly politicised calculation and very much her throwing barbs at the former government about the fact that they had spending plans which they knew they would overshoot, but they weren't honest about it with themselves, with the Treasury, or with the general public. And so Rachel Reeves Reeves' first kind of major, I think, introduction to the British public as Chancellor was doing this big set piece unveiling of the black hole, which is very much about the immediate fiscal pressures this year and moving into next year, which she thinks that is now another headache that Labour has to deal with, which they didn't really know the size of.
Christian, can we identify two separate elements in that? The one is whatever it was that was new that could credibly claim not to have been known about before. And the second one is Meereen referred to Rachel Reeves taking measures. Can you remind us what those measures have been and just how much work they do?
There wasn't any sort of really big announcement that raised a lot of money or saved a lot of money in the July statement Rachel Reeves made. The biggest one was means testing the winter fuel payment for pensioners. That was about $1.5 billion. Then there was scrapping various roads and other sort of infrastructure programs. But that was all, in all cases, we are still going to be spending more than the previous government had planned to do. So it's quite hard to see these are cuts in the sense where less money is going to be spent than previously expected.
Right. Now, this takes us back to what Meereen mentioned, the famous fiscal rules. Before we go any further, why do we set fiscal rules at all?
Well, it's worth saying we've had an awful lot of fiscal rules since Gordon Brown first introduced them in the UK back in the late 1990s, and they've nearly all been broken and then abandoned. That said, they do provide some sort of framework so that you've got some kind of idea where policy is going to go, as long as there aren't sort of shocks. Of course, shocks come along with alarming regularity, and rules are often just abandoned at that point. I'd say there's another really important aspect of fiscal rules, and that's actually about internal government management. So the Treasury sits in the middle of government, and everybody wants more money. I mean, whether you're in the Education Department, or the Justice Department, or the Health Department, or indeed if you're in one of the myriad of lobbying organisations outside of government, you all want more money. And I think chancellors find it very useful to be able to go to their ministers or others asking for money and say, look, there is a rule here. I'd love to help you. I'd really love to help you. But if I give you more money, then in order to meet my fiscal rule, I'm either going to have to take it off someone else or increase taxes. I can't borrow more in order to give you more money.
Right. In a way, we've described the history of them. We've maybe not quite got down to what one actually is. Christian, what is our current fiscal rule?
Well, we've got two, but the one that bites, or the one that really matters, is a rule on public sector debt. And that is that debt needs to be falling between the fourth and the fifth year of the forecast. So it's nothing to do with what debt is now. Debt can explode. It can double in the next year. That would be quite an extreme situation. But so long as it's falling between year four and year five, as a share of national income, so debt as a share of national income, is so long as that's coming down, so it's not actually paying down any debt, then you meet your fiscal rule. So you meet it in a forecast, not in reality.
Oh, hold on. Does that mean that you can spend what you like in the first 4 years as long as between year four and five it's going down again?
If you had a profile of your forecast, which the Independent Office for Budget Responsibility put into their forecast, which they have to do by law. So you give them how much you're spending. So you say, we're going to spend, I don't know, let's say £2 trillion a year for years one to four, and then £1 trillion in year four and five, such that debt falls between years four and five, but explodes up to then. Yes, that would be passing the rule.
Okay. And from what we've been told, Meereen, they're not actually binding anyway. I mean, Paul's described how they can be used to browbeat other ministers, spending ministers and so on. But doesn't everybody more or less say, well, look, actually, Chancellor, you tell us we're constrained by this, but we all know that you can make up your own rules.
And they have. So we have a fiscal rule, which actually Rachel Reeves has decided to keep the fiscal rule of her predecessor, who was forced to create this fiscal rule because he came into office at a time when the public finances were on fire, which is after the mini budget. But in the UK, the fiscal rules are effectively what the chancellors decide they are. As Paul said, they almost never met and they always changed. And that's not true in all jurisdictions. In some countries, they really are rules. Actually, they are constitutionally laid out. You know, governments, particularly in countries like Germany, can be sued over their very stringent fiscal rules, something called the debt brake, which has probably had a really deleterious impact on German politics and German public finances for a long time. So maybe we shouldn't be so sniffy about the fact that we have maximum flexibility in the UK to interpret a fiscal rule as we wish.
Well, you anticipate my next question to Paul, which is, do the fiscal rules, do we think, hinder or help the British economy?
It depends on the situation. I mean, I think the first thing it's important to be clear about in terms of the current fiscal rule is that it is really biting in the sense that there's no room for manoeuvre against it. If we want to spend more, we're going to have to tax more. So that sounds like it's really tight and stopping Chancellors doing things. It's actually a really loose fiscal rule in the way that Chris described. I mean, debt falling in the fifth year of the forecast period is not a tight rule. It's just that we genuinely have a big debt and fiscal problem. So whether you've got a rule or not, the underlying economic reality is the same. And there is a limit, as we saw in September 2022, to what you can do. Now, the fiscal rule is not a scientific estimate of exactly where that limit exists, but it's a sort of, it's an effort to constrain in a way which tries to ensure that you don't end up with the kind of disaster that we had back in September 2022.
Chris Johnson, can we just go back to that very thing? That was widely described as having happened because the markets did not believe in the government's policy. In other words, the fiscal rule partially exists to reassure people outside that you actually have some kind of notion of what you're doing.
Yeah, I think it's best to look at them. I mean, I was very rude about it just a second ago, but it's actually best to look at it as a rule of thumb. So broadly speaking, if you meet your fiscal rules and if other people think your policies are credible that you will meet your fiscal rules, things will broadly be okay. I think that's the best way to look at it. And in that sense, fiscal rules are worthwhile. And what happened in autumn 2022 was the government said, we don't care about the fiscal rules. We don't care about the institutions that oversee them, certainly not in the short term, because we think we know better. And we're going to impose a policy or give you a policy which has much looser public finances because we think this is best for the economy. And what they failed to realise was they don't actually decide what's best for the economy in the limit, because people in financial markets who lend money to the government decide. So if the government didn't need to borrow money, they would decide. Government, Parliament is sovereign. But if you're borrowing a lot of money, you do need to have things in place, whether they're rules or policies, that give confidence to the people who are lending to you.
Right. I think this very much kind of sets the background to where we're going now, which is the limitations or possibilities for Rachel Reeves when she sets the budget in the autumn. Marion Khan, we use the phrase boxed in. How boxed in is she?
Well, I think in some senses, Jeremy Hunt's fiscal rule has been more successful than probably he could have ever imagined, because he's forced his successor to take it on. And she's in a space where she doesn't think she could abandon or change the fiscal rule she's inherited, because it's become so central to how Labour think about fiscal credibility, or at least how Labour think the financial markets think about fiscal credibility in the UK. So actually, it's probably the most wildly successful fiscal rule that we've ever had in the UK, given how it's been passed on from one government to another and from one parliament to another. I can't remember that happening in recent times. So the way Labour are sort of perceiving their job now as a government that has a big mandate and is going to be in office for the next 5 years, is that there are still these lingering potential questions about the UK's fiscal sustainability, which is the part of the overhang of the Liz Truss legacy. And it's not really willing to take any risks by making any big departures from what it considers to be credible rules. And they've decided that Jeremy Hunt's rule, the debt rules we've spoken about, is a credible one. She's definitely hemmed in by it, because we've already spoken about this 22 billion. UK government borrowing so far in this fiscal year is already overshooting what the OBR thought we were at in March this year. So in March, the former Chancellor only had about 9 billion in headroom. We're already overshooting that. Various things, because of the interest rate environment is different. The debt interest is probably higher than we thought it was going to be. Loads of little things which are adding up. And it's adding more pressure on alongside that overspend that we've already discussed in the black hole. So yeah, she's definitely constrained by it. And weirdly enough, yes, it's a tight and a loose fiscal rule. If there's a target, it has to be met. Jeremy Hunt did it in quite a cynical way. He was giving us tax cuts to national insurance in the first couple of years of his forecast, and then paying for them with quite tight austerity in the latter part of his forecast. And that's the inheritance, and that's the kind of the sequencing that Rachel Reeves is having to fight and to tackle. And that's why we're in a world where we know there are tax rises coming in this budget.
Right, so let's go straight there, Paul, to look at what she's likely to do to raise money, or at the very least to kind of close this gap somewhat, presumably in order to create some space in future budgets that the government might have when it wants to kind of begin to do some other things.
Yeah, and that's where what Merine says is so important, that the reason that Rachel Reeves is going to look to raise taxes is that in the forecast at the moment that she was bequeathed by the Conservatives, the assumption is that spending effective will be cut across a range of public services over the next 4 or 5 years, and indeed that investment spending will be cut as well as day-to-day spending on public services. To avoid that, and to meet the fiscal rules that we spent quite a long time talking about, she will need to raise taxes one way or another. Now, the scale of that will depend on what the OBR forecasts are and indeed whether she makes some technical changes to some of the measures of debt and so on. But, you know, the big picture is she's likely to need some tax rises. And actually, part of the reason for that is that Jeremy Hunt did cut taxes by £20 billion in the last year of his chancellorship. Labour voted for those cuts, and they promised to keep them in place. And this is where I think she's really boxed in, because in the Labour manifesto, they were very clear they wouldn't raise income tax, wouldn't raise national insurance contributions, and wouldn't raise the rate of corporation tax. Now, those between them raise about three quarters of all of our tax revenue. And if you say, I'm not going to raise any of those, that leaves you with limited possibilities. It makes it limit even more when you say in your manifesto, we're not going to raise taxes on working people. If you take that literally, there is no tax that is available to raise, because I can't think of any tax that isn't in some way paid by some working people. But I think we can just take that as rhetorical, overblown stuff. So are there options here? Well, first of all, clearly didn't mean it on income tax, because there is a £10 billion income tax rise coming in, which is another 3 years, we assume, of freezes in income tax thresholds and allowances. That means more and more of your income is brought into tax and higher rates of tax. Now, we assume that's going to happen. The previous Chancellor had it in his forecast, and we've heard nothing from Labour saying they're not going to do that. If they don't do it, that's another £10 billion to their black hole. They appear to be talking about changes to pensions taxation. We can go into that. There are good ways and bad ways of increasing the taxation on the money that goes into private pensions. If you do it in the good ways, there's not a huge amount of money available.
Very briefly, what would be a good way? What would be a bad way?
Well, a bad way, in my view, would be to restrict the tax allowance to the basic rate. So at the moment, if you're a higher rate taxpayer, you get tax relief at 40%. Now, there's lots of people have suggested, well, you could get maybe 15, 20 billion a year. So you get serious money if you say for everyone, you only get 20% relief. Now, why would that be bad? A, it would be extremely complicated for some people. But secondly, it would mean quite a lot of people essentially being double taxed on their pension savings. Would that be disastrous? No, you know, you could do that, and it must be pretty tempting. There are better ways of doing it. I mean, you can inherit someone's pension entirely free of tax. That seems to me to be absolutely mad. And, you know, that's something that should clearly be
well
closed.
I was going to ask Chris Jars this, because we've heard this phrase, broader shoulders, and this seems to be some kind of a promise that whoever's going to get hit has broader shoulders. Do we have any understanding who exactly has the broader shoulders?
Well, we know people, it's either going to be people with high incomes or high wealth. One difficulty that the Labour government has is actually people with broader shoulders have been paying quite significantly more tax under the previous Conservative government since 2010. So although it's sort of in popular discourse that inequality has been rising and that the rich are getting richer and that all the tax burden's been going on the middle and the poor, actually none of what I've just said is true. Inequality has been falling. The rich haven't really been getting richer, and not getting richer as much as people at the bottom and middle end, particularly in the working age population. And the tax system has already been skewed pretty much towards the top end. Now, that doesn't mean you can't raise more tax from richer people, but you've got one problem, which is always the case. There's not that many people in the country where everyone agrees their shoulders are broad. And that means that you won't raise an enormous amount of money. It's quite hard to get enormous amounts of money, of the billions that Marine, Paul and I have been talking about, from a small subset of maybe 100,000 people we can all think are super, super, mega wealthy.
Can I just interrupt there quickly, just to agree very strongly with what Chris has said, and just really ram it home, because I think this is something where there's been, you know, I talked a lot about conspiracies of silence before the election, about the public finances in particular. There's been an enormous conspiracy of silence between Conservatives and Labour about what the Conservatives did to the tax system. The Conservatives hammered rich people, and they don't want to say that because that's their natural voters, and Labour don't want to say that because they think it's a good thing.
Okay, so Marion, taking up this point about the broader shoulders, I mean, what about things like capital gains tax?
That's definitely an area where I think there is pressure and somewhere where I guess the Chancellor has been less categorical about ruling out new taxes. So one thing she's definitely said, and she said in the House of Commons this week, that Labour is not going to raise the rate of corporation tax in this Parliament. It's going to stay where it is. So that was obviously a big political battleground between the previous Tory governments. But capital gains is different. It's the money that the government can charge on people when they want to sell assets that rise in value, for shares, for example, or if you're an entrepreneur who wants to sell their business. I think this is part of that constituency, the broad shoulder constituency, or at least the constituency that Labour can target politically. There's talk about equalising the rate of capital gains tax with income tax. That will probably simplify the tax system.
Well, it sounds fair, doesn't it?
It sounds fair in practice. There will be, I think, again, administrative problems about how this happens. If Labour do want to do an equalisation between income and capital gains, they'll also have to think about the rate of inflation, which is applied to the value of assets. So this could raise a lot of money, but there will probably be some things at the edges, which means that it will be perhaps could be one of the big money makers in this budget.
One of the issues here is that capital gains tax raises something 16, 17 billion a year at the moment. That's a handy sum, but it's nothing like the 200 billion or whatever the income tax raises. And changes to capital gains tax are needed. Actually, a big reform of capital gains tax is needed. It's a terrible tax at the moment, partly because it's charged at lower rates, partly, as Maureen was saying, you get no allowance for inflation. So if you make a big capital gain because there's been lots of inflation, you still pay a load of tax on it, which is completely ludicrous. And then there are, again, things where it's just totally forgiven. People hold on to assets until death because there's no tax on the capital gain after you die. So people hold on to things for far too long. So you need a reform as well as an increase. And my worry is that if they do it quickly, big reform this budget, a couple of months after they've been elected, the scope for getting it wrong is pretty serious.
But I suppose what they could do is say, we're not going to do it quickly, but we will at some point do it.
Then you've got the problem that people anticipate that. So if you sell, according to Chris's newspaper and probably Marine's, people are already thinking hard about, I better sell my stuff now because I'm expecting capital gains tax to change after the budget. So it's something that you need to, it's a really awkward one, actually, getting the timing and the precision correct.
Chris, that leads to this question before we come on to the question of spending cuts, which is, are there trade-offs between tax rises and future growth? The government says growth is what we're about. People look at tax rises, quite a lot of them, and say, actually, this may impinge upon future growth.
Of course there are trade-offs. There's trade-offs in everything we do in economics and in public finances for certain. I think the biggest trade-off is in bad tax increases and future growth. So if you did what Paul just said and didn't think about a capital gains tax, so you got it wrong and you didn't think of one of the unforeseen consequences, and not necessarily people all leaving the country in a huff, but people taking action to avoid the tax, which is perfectly legal, but that action also undermines the economy in many other ways. So that is what you really need to think very hard about. And it happens all the time that governments get this sort of thing wrong, not because they're stupid, because it's really complicated. And so I think these trade-offs definitively exist. Is there a trade-off between the overall rate level of tax and growth? Yes, but probably not very large, so long as you have good taxes. So if we had a perfect tax system and raised the same amount as now, I'm sure the economy could grow faster. So if you could do a great reform where you increase tax a bit and made the tax system better, you can probably still have more growth and more taxes.
Room for spending cuts. Is there actually any, Marion?
I think there's not that much fat left to trim. The government has told us some things it wants to do. War on waste, cutting government spending on management consultancies, making some administrative savings, a few millions here on the social media accounts of government ministries. But this is pretty thin stuff.
When have we not ever not been told that?
That we're going to have a war on waste.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's been a particular targeting of consultancies, which this government seems to have taken head on. But yeah, so we're hearing the sort of rhetoric around, waste and bureaucracy that the previous government is guilty of. This government hasn't really made as strong a commitment to the increase in defence spending of at least 2.5% of GDP, which the former government did. So it's given itself a bit more maximum flexibility to stick to its existing NATO target of 2% of GDP without, seemingly to be more ambitious. So defence spending is another massive fiscal pressure that lots of countries, rich countries, are now having to face after a structural decline in defence spending for decades. There's not unless the other two disagree with me, I don't think that there's a massive area where you can say, here's a lot of money that we could save without Labour reneging on its manifesto promises about what it wants to do to the public services, which leads me to think that this budget will actually include far more borrowing than the right now where we stand that the government is likely to admit.
Far more borrowing somehow within the fiscal rule.
Yes.
It sounds like an odd thing to ask, but I'm going to ask you about rays of hope. Chris, can we start with you?
Interest rates are high relative to the period of the last 15 years, and they are likely to be lower in the next few years, I would have thought. So that means you will get some of the debt interest cost coming down, and that money can be recycled. That's one ray of hope for you.
Although you can't quantify it, but we think it's likely to move in that direction.
But it's big. Let's be absolutely clear. This isn't a small thing. So you can get tens of billions if interest rates, if we can get to a situation where we've got lower, longer-term interest rates because inflation's under control and we've got faster growth. So it's not, we're not just got lower interest rates because the economy is doing really badly, but we have lower interest rates because we think that's a more of a sort of steady situation is normal with higher growth. It's not to say that we would suddenly be rolling in money, but it would transform some of the bleakness that, you know, we've been talking about this afternoon.
But might it not also mean, Paul Johnson, that the government would have a significant amount of additional money that the government itself could invest directly, rather than rely upon the private sector to invest?
Well, the government, again, you know, they don't want to shout about this, but their plans are to cut public investment spending. Again, they've inherited that from the last government, and broadly speaking, the plans are to cut it further.
This year.
Over the next 5 years. Now, we'll see whether Rachel Reeves changes that in the budget, but that's what's in the numbers, and to invest more would make the numbers more difficult again. But you asked for some rays of hope. I think the government might get lucky. You know, I'm not saying they will, and I'm saying it's a more than 50% chance, but I think they might get lucky. So we've had dreadful growth in wages and the economy over the last 15 or more years. Now, some of that was to do with government policy. A lot of it is to do with the long overhang of the financial crisis in this country. Now, it may sound like ancient history, 2008, 2010, but actually there's a long overhang from that. We've had zero interest rates for a long time until the last few years. That's been really bad, in my view, for the economy. And whilst they've come down, they were not, I presume, not going to come down to zero. So we might just get lucky.
Marion.
I think it's worth taking some sucker into the fact that as a country and a government, we do seem to be confronting all of these difficulties head on. I mean, this is not a uniquely British problem. Rising debt levels, difficult public finances, aging populations. These are issues that are being suffered by countries around the world. If I think of the US right now, which is in an electoral cycle, both candidates for president seem to conveniently forget that the deficit in the US is 7% and very few seem to have plans to bring it down. In France, the deficit is running nearly 6%. They don't even have a government that could produce a budget to bring that down within the next couple of months. And we already mentioned Germany, where they probably have the opposite problem and they're constrained by their fiscal rules because they probably need to do more spending to help reflate the German economy, consume demand in Germany and the rest of the Eurozone. And they also don't seem to have a political establishment that's willing to take that on. So I do take some comfort into the fact that we're all in business because we have to talk about how difficult the trade-offs are. And we probably have a government that for now is definitely hamming up how terrible things are. And in some senses, that is a way of exposing and laying bare just how hard these choices are.
Do you mean some investment economists are going around at the moment saying, maybe you should think about buying into Britain now?
They actually are. Goldman Sachs this week said exactly that. If you think about the growth problems in the Eurozone and the labour market problems in the US, the UK might have escaped both of those problems. So I'm not saying that we're going to be a ray of sunshine or the island of stability that I think Rachel Reeves has mentioned that the UK could become. But it's worth putting us into a context where other governments, other social contracts are under exactly the same type of strain. And perhaps not all of those countries are having the centrality of fiscal policy is not that obvious in all of those countries that I've mentioned.
My thanks to Marion Kahn, Chris Charles and Paul Johnson. And my conclusion? Reasons to be cheerful are one. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Caroline Bailey and Kirstine Knight. The editor was Richard Varden and the sound engineers were Sarah Hockley and Gareth Jones. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
It's the 1980s and a young bodybuilder named William Dillon leaves rural Illinois behind for sun-drenched California in search of a supersized American dream. to get absolutely jacked.
When you're muscular, when you're big, you get respect.
But he's about to discover the secret to why so many of the bodybuilders around him are getting ripped quick. This is the story of the biggest illegal steroid operation the United States had ever seen.
Literally hundreds, if not a thousand needles, came down like the heavens were falling.
I'm Natalia Petrozella. From BBC Radio 4, this is Extreme. Muscle Men. Listen first on BBC Sounds.